Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Ben Sidran is one of those guys who makes your knees buckle. Piano player, singer, author, composer, host of the NPR series Jazz Alive, host of the VH1 TV's New Vision series, Peabody winner, Ace winner, friend of rock and roller Steve Miller, played in his band, producer of recordings by Diana Ross, Van Morrison, Ricky Lee Jones. And did I say recording artist? Of course he holds a PhD, and here he is on Back Nine from his latest album, Don't Cry for No Hipster.
My way to the back nine. They call me the Iron Man. Watching out for the sand traps. Formulating my plan. Out on the back nine. I know how to do my thing. I traded in the five spot.
Ben Sidran is a University of Wisconsin-Madison grad where I first bumped into him. He'll be in town on Sunday at the Jewish Community Center, and he joins us now from Madtown. Ben, welcome. Such a pleasure to have you.
Thanks, Steve. Pleasure to be with you.
You know, I'm not the first one to tell you that you make the rest of us feel bad, Ben.
Well, I'm just passing it on, you know. They made me feel bad, too, when I was growing up.
I did notice that you don't repair farm implements, Ben.
No, I don't do farm implements either, and I'm not much at playwriting. So there's a couple things I can't do.
Well, there are many things people who, you know, many things that people who do all the things you do. I mean, why so much diversity in what you do?
Well, honestly, you know, for me, it there is a unity to it. I'm always involved in some aspect of the music business and music production, and I'm also always involved in a kind of journalism. You know, writing songs is a form of journalism, and when I write books or whatever it is, it's journalism. So the combination of jazz and journalism is kind of the catch-all of my activities.
Do you ever feel pulled in too many directions?
No, never really. As a matter of fact, I find having a diversity around me helps me go forward. You know, a lot of times I'll be working on a project and I'll get stuck, you know, and then rather than just sit there and scratch my head, I'll go do something else, you know, work on a different project, and that'll move the whole thing forward. So, no, I've found that it really works well.
Hey, have you ever had any regret that maybe you should have focused on just one thing and just sort of going with that and seeing how far you could have taken it?
Yeah, I have. That's absolutely correct. I realized much too late, actually, that had I focused on my performing career when it began in the 70s, had I really, you know, bore down on it then, I could have made some serious progress. Similarly with, you know, some theoretical stuff in the performing aspect of jazz. I wish I had focused on it then. But, you know, had I done that, I wouldn't have done the other stuff. So it's really hard to know.
You know, of all the things I ticked off that you do, Ben, you know, piano player, singer, author, composer, you know, friend of rock and roller Steve Miller, which one's the toughest? I mean, what's the hardest for you to pull off?
Friend of Steve Miller.
I knew you were going there. As soon as I said it. Yeah. Yeah. But seriously.
Seriously, the hardest to pull off is performing, simply because it takes so much heavy lifting, not to do the performance, but to set it up, get to the venue, travel, you know, arrange all the details that need to be arranged. There's a lot of background noise and information in being a performer that you have to go through just to get to those 2 hours when you're on stage. That take a lot of patience, and it's not my forte. You know, my forte really is being in a room with creative people doing stuff. I love that.
Author and musician Ben Sidran is our guest. Ben, you've produced recordings by Diana Ross, Van Morrison, and Ricky Lee Jones, and undoubtedly others. Take me into the studio with Diana Ross. I mean, is that an uplifting experience, a challenging experience, or an experience you'd never repeat again if your life depended on it?
No, in that case, it was really a great experience. She was terrific. You know, she's Miss Ross to all the people around her, and she really is the diva, the classic diva. But when she's in a studio with good musicians working on a project, she is a musician, and she likes having musicians talk to her as a musician. She's very talented. She works quickly. She trusts the people around her to do a good job, which makes, you know, your job easier if you're working with her. I found working with Diana Ross really was a lot easier than working with a lot of, you know, newcomer types who are more defensive. She was terrific. On the other hand, you know, Ricky Lee Jones, for example, was really a problem to work with because her method, her process of working is adversarial. She likes to kind of set up an adversity and then overcome it in the studio. And so there's a lot of back and forth and negativity in the room when she's there.
An adversity like what?
Oh, I don't like the way that bass player is playing. He sounds too old.
Really?
You know,
really?
What does that mean? Well, I just don't like it. Stuff like that, you know, creating a problem that there really is no solution for.
How about Van Morrison?
Van's very interesting. I just saw him a few weeks ago. I was in London, and he, at bottom, is really a sweetheart. I mean, he is totally dedicated to the music and a terrific artist. But he's also a crazed Irish poet, you know, and he's inspired when he's performing. There's no question about it. He just totally surrenders to the performance, and he tries to take that into the recording studio. So when you're in the recording studio with Van, you have to assume that whatever you're doing at that moment might show up on a record someday, and it keeps you on your toes.
You and Steve Miller, the great rock and roller, are longtime friends. I gather you two met at Madison?
Yeah. We met here in 1962. Steve and Boz Skaggs and myself all played in a little rock and roll band together for about a year here at Madison. And then we stayed friends. He went on to San Francisco and got in the recording business, and I was in England going to graduate school, and he came over to London to make a record, and I joined him on the record, and one thing led to another, and we made a bunch of records over the years and wrote songs together.
Well, that album with, or that group with you and Boz and Steve Miller, that must have been a heck of a group, Ben.
It was a great fraternity band. That's my memory of it. We played, you know, all these T-Bone Walker and Jimmy Reed kind of tunes and the local R&B sort of Texas shuffle things, and had a great time. It was really a great rock and roll fraternity style band. It was a party band.
What frat was it?
Well, Steve was a member of Chi Psi. I was not a member of any fraternity, nor I don't think it was Boz. But we played at all the fraternities. I mean, a fraternity band in the sense that on campus back in those days, the best parties were at fraternity houses. You know, it was very much like the scene that is parodied in Animal House, but those parties were great. And so we would play a lot of them. We'd play Friday and Saturday nights and afternoons, and it was fantastic.
Well, you and Steve Miller composed the hit Space Cowboy. Let's listen. That sounds like a good frat band song.
That's just what it is. That's exactly what it is.
How did you two come up with that thing?
We were sitting in a hotel room in Los Angeles. We had been in the recording studio, and back then, when that was 45 years ago, I guess, we would make records mostly by going in the studio and coming up with grooves, and then once we had something that we liked the way it sounded, we would go write lyrics to it. I mean, we'd spend 4 or 5 weeks in the studio doing this sort of thing. That's why most of those early rock and roll records were made, the Rolling Stones and the Who. I mean, a lot of this stuff was composed in the studio. So we had done that rhythm track, and the producer of that record was a guy named Glyn Johns, who was British, who came over to work with us, and he had produced The Who and lots of other bands. And it was his suggestion to come up with a futuristic theme for the record. So Steve and I were sitting there thinking about a futuristic theme and coming up with words. And the Beatles had just done a song called Glass Onion, where McCartney said, I told you about Strawberry Fields,
oh, yeah,
a place where nothing is real.
Yeah.
So I said, hey, Steve, why don't we say I told you about living in the USA and, you know, I'm a gangster of love, because those were two songs from the previous album. And we just started going along like that. And when it came to the part where the hook comes in, Steve said, I'm a space cowboy. I don't know where it came from. It just popped out of his mouth. And I must have looked incredulous because he said, I bet you weren't ready for that. And I said, well, we'll keep that too. That's how that happened.
So that's how music history gets made.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like all the rest of history, it just sort of happens.
Well, why didn't the Steve Miller Band just become your life, Ben?
Oh, you know, I'm really not that into the rock and roll world. It's generally speaking an inch deep and a mile wide.
Mm-hmm.
The level of culture that's involved, the fact that everything is reduced to product and sold, and you know, it's not the kind of experience that I wanted to devote my time to. It's really all about money and very little about history and culture and sociology, which is what I've always been interested in. My first interest was jazz music. I mean, you know, talking to somebody in Kansas City is even exciting for me because it's such a great jazz city. You know, I'm saying my
yeah.
whole life has been following these heroes of mine. And while pop music was fun at the time, it was a lot of fun because it was new. Now it seems kind of old and tired to me. I mean, the last gig I played with Steve, I produced a record for him in the late 80s. It was kind of a blues, jazzy kind of a record. And we went out and played gigs in the summer. We played Kansas City, I'm sure. We played all over. And we were in our late 40s at the time. And I said to Steve, you know, I feel too old to be out here playing this stuff.
Huh.
It just doesn't feel appropriate to me.
Huh. Ben Sidern will be at the Jewish Community Center in Overland Park at 2 o'clock on Sunday. You can see and hear him. More information, 913-327-8054. That's for tickets, 913-327-8054. Well, let's turn to jazz just for a minute here, Ben. You got a chance to interview just some of the great giants of jazz, Miles Davis, Dizzy Gillespie, Sonny Rollins, for your Talking Jazz collection. What did talking with these peers and mentors in jazz wind up doing for you?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I talked to, for example, I got to talk to Miles Davis, but I also got to talk
to
a lot of
that last night. Yeah, yeah.
Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. He was sweet, right?
He
was generous and funny. I mean, a lot of times people would think of him as being hard to hang out with, but I thought he was just lovely. And the main thing I got, and I got it, you know, from just about everybody, is that the message of jazz is to be yourself, to find out what you do, what you like, who you are, and stay with that. That's your best shot. And, you know, when you're young and you're coming up, there's not a lot of people telling you that. Generally, everybody's saying, try this, try that, be like this person, be like that person. But the whole message of the jazz life to me is you have to find your own voice, find out who you are, and then find a way to fit into the tradition so that you can work with other people. You know, you're not alone. You're part of this great, rich tradition. But at the same time, you have to find your own story to tell. And that's what really what Sonny Rollins or Miles Davis, what it all came down to, is that their style and their art came from their personal experience and their personal exploration.
Well, when you were talking to Miles, you were sitting out on what, the back deck of his home overlooking the ocean, and you can hear the water lapping up on shore, right?
Yeah, you can hear the waves. It was in Malibu, California, and we were out on the back deck, and we're sitting there, you know, drinking iced drinks, and he was drawing, and we were just chatting. But I had spent the entire day there. I must have spent eight hours at Miles' house, and we had lunch, and we listened to music, and we had just a great time.
You know, he made a point with you that I've read elsewhere as well about his seminal jazz album, Kind of Blue, which is the greatest selling jazz record ever made, still selling like crazy. And if our listeners haven't heard that, go out and get it today or get it mailed to you. It's just absolutely amazing. But Miles was talking to you about the contribution of the pianist Bill Evans to that album as being perhaps the most significant element in the creation of that record, which I find such an interesting idea.
Well, you know, Miles loved that kind of hovering, haunted harmony that Bill Evans used, and also Gil Evans, you know, the arranger that he worked with. Two very influential white jazz musicians in the career of Miles Davis. And, you know, a lot of people like to paint Miles with a racial brush. And I don't think that was true at all. He was very adamant about the importance of black music and black musicians. But he was a musician, and he was all about music. And he was not hesitant to credit Bill Evans on that record. And the harmonic innovations that Bill Evans made really contributed to that record being at the same time one of the most modern records. Even today you hear it. It's very modern sounding. At the same time, just steeped in the blues.
Yeah.
A fantastic formula that changed jazz, really.
You know, what holds jazz back in this country? Because, you know, that's an issue here in Kansas City as well, Ben, which, you know, we obviously, as you've already mentioned, we have this incredible jazz heritage here, but the music struggles. It's surviving, maybe even thriving at certain venues, but overall you sort of wonder about its health. What's behind that?
Well, you know, jazz is like the canary in the coal mine. It really tells you a lot about the culture that you're in, and the American culture tends to be a commercial culture. It's really interested in product, buying and selling product, and to the extent that jazz artifacts like CDs sell and generate money for corporations, you'll hear a lot about it. But what you find in Europe and all over in the rest of the world is jazz is seeing is like one of the greatest contributions of the American culture because of its blending of everyday life, you know, the life of the average man. The guy goes into a club on a Tuesday night, you know, he might hear some of the greatest art being performed on the planet at that time. Certainly, if you had gone into the club and heard Charlie Parker in Kansas City at that time, that would have been as good as it got. And yet it was just a Tuesday night and people were having drinks. That combination of high art and popular culture is what lights up the world when they think of jazz. But here in the United States, it's just Tuesday night, you know, and so we don't see it in the context that it's seen in the rest of the world. It's always been the case, though, with jazz, and I don't think that it's necessarily bad for the music. I think it's hard for the musicians, but the music still survives.
You know, you once said that your job on Talking Jazz was to demystify the jazz musician and the life of the jazz musician and show that these guys, you know, are pretty much like the rest of us, maybe even only more so. What do you mean they're like the rest of us, maybe only more so?
Yeah. Well, you know, I was thinking about how I remember saying that. And what I was thinking about was how people tend to talk about jazz musicians as, you know, well, particularly back in the day. Now you have a lot of very articulate, well-educated white middle-class jazz musicians, so they don't seem quite so exotic to the rest of the world. But back then, you know, in the 60s and 50s, and you know, jazz musicians were seen as very exotic creatures, and they might be studied as in the academies, but mm-hmm. they weren't considered like the insurance guy who lived next to you. And yet the life of that guy was very similar. He had to get a mortgage, he had to get insurance, he had to raise a family. Jazz musicians, by and large, were dealing with the same things that everybody else was dealing with, only had to do it in the midst of trying to find, as I said, their own voice and travel around and make a living. So their problems were just like everybody else's, only more so, only more difficult. Everybody has a trouble buying a house, but if you're a jazz musician, it's very hard to get a mortgage, that sort of thing. So my goal was to let people know that these were not unusual people in what they aspired to. They were unusual in how they lived their lives. That was it.
Yeah, that's great. I saw an interview with you once from, I think it was back in 1978, where CBS's Pat O'Brien described you as one of those artists who travels in the music business underground. Was that by conscious design on your part, and do you feel like you still occupy that space in the industry of being in the music business underground, Ben?
I am, and I'm happy to be there. It's kind of why I named the last record I made, Don't Cry for No Hipster. Mm-hmm. And of course, today the idea of a hipster is kind of a fashion statement, you know, kids in skinny ties and small hats. But that's not what I was talking about. I was talking about this way of life that goes back to jazz musicians who had invented their own way of talking and looking at the world. And it included philosophy, it included a certain bohemian style, it included sense of humor. I really always aspired to try to live that life, and to live it truly, not as a cartoon or not as a theatrical piece, but to see if it was possible to live life on the pulse, being true to the stuff you loved and being part of it, not outside of it looking in. I always wanted to know what it was like to get paid like a musician got paid and to feel what my heroes had felt. And so I was always interested in pursuing that, and I've spent my life pursuing it, and I have no regrets about that. It was everything I had hoped it would be, and more so. And meeting my heroes and getting to talk to them about these things. You know, the great saxophone player Phil Woods, he refers to the tradition that we're in as being jazz warriors. And he talks about musicians as being warriors, you know. Mm. And I once asked Phil, I said, what's it like to be at your stage where you can play anything you can hear and you're celebrated around the world? And he said, well, you know, playing is no problem, Ben, but as you get older, wanting to play becomes the problem. Desire for desire becomes the problem. And that's everybody's problem in life. As you get older, the things that you cared about when you were younger, you have to wake up every day and remember why you cared so much. And I think by being in this underground, if you want to call it that, has kept me focused on what was important to me, and I appreciate that.
We're visiting with author and musician Ben Sidran. You wrote a book last year. It's titled There Was a Fire, Jews, Music, and the American Dream, which, you know, is as much historical text as it is a personal rumination on your own heritage. How did you first start to think about that topic?
Well, you know, like many mid-20th century Jewish kids, I was kind of straddling the European Ashkenazi tradition and the American tradition. I was bar mitzvahed at age 13, but after that I never went back to the synagogue, really. I got involved in music, and I was in the temple of bebop, more or less. And when I eventually had a child of my own, when he was like 4 or 5 years old, I wanted him to have some sense of the tradition.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm an agnostic. I don't believe in the deity, but I do believe in social justice, and I do believe in the Jewish tradition that it's called Tikkun Olam, of trying to leave the world a better place than you found it. And so I got involved in doing the music at a little high holiday service, the Rosh Hashanah service here in Madison, Wisconsin, and that led to making this record called Life's a Lesson, which was some liturgical songs that I remembered from my childhood, but performed by 25 just great Jewish jazz musicians, from Lee Konitz to Josh Redman. Carole King sang on it. And that kind of propelled me into the world of contemporary Jewish culture, because just playing that music and traveling around, I mean, I played it at Lincoln Center and at the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles, played it all over in museums and concert halls, and met all these people. And so I got into a lot of discussions about Jewish music, and what I found was nobody was really talking about the importance or the impact of Jewish contributors to American popular culture, least of all the Jews, you know. Like, if you, there is a famous interview with Irving Berlin where he's asked, what does being a Jew have to do with your success? He said, nothing. He said, I'm an American, plain and simple. He wrote God Bless America. He also wrote White Christmas and Easter Parade, but he didn't write any Jewish songs. Similarly, Gershwin said being a Jew was not that significant. Dylan said that. So it occurred to me that that was probably a very Jewish thing to say in America, that being a Jew had very little to do with it. And so I started kind of turning the crystal ball around and looking at all these composers and producers and publishers and songwriters and executives and artists in the popular music field, and examining how they actually invented what we think of as the American dream. And because it's popular music, everybody knows about it. Everybody has accepted it more or less as who we are. And so in a sense, America is a very Jewish country, even though very few people think of it that way.
You know, one interesting part of the book struck me is this mixing of the Jewish American experience and the African American experience in music. To what extent do you think that's worked?
Well, I think that is the key to American popular culture. It's blacks and Jews, plain and simple. to what extent
are you serious,
worked?
Or are you kidding?
Oh, no, I'm absolutely serious. Without the African-American experience and the Jewish experience, we would not have the popular culture that we have, from films to literature to music, certainly, to theater, to Broadway. I mean, all that came out of the culture and the tradition of African-Americans and Jewish immigrants around the first three or four decades of the 20th century, outsider culture. The fact that modern man is by nature alienated, and who better to express that than African-Americans and Jews, you know? And I think one of the great tragedies of the 20th century is the rift that opened between the African-American community and the Jewish community. And I think, it's a heartbreak for those of us involved in the music business, because so much richness, so much love and humor came out of that relationship. I mean, in the 30s, black musicians were speaking Yiddish and Jewish musicians were speaking jive, you know? There was a common culture.
Well, Ben, we just have a minute or so left. I want to end this interview by just chatting with you for a moment about your son. You two collaborated on an album, El Elefante, a few years ago. This is a song that Ben and Leo did together. This one is Let's Go to Tegucigalpa.
Hey, vámonos. What's that? Vámonos. What'd you say? Vamos. Okay. Let's go to Tegucigalpa, let's go to Tegucigalpa, let's go to Tegucigalpa, let's go to Tegucigalpa. Well, Tegucigalpa.
Where is Tegucigalpa?
Well, it's Tegucigalpa, which is in Mexico.
Yes.
Like the record is a bilingual kids record. It's
sure.
Spanish and English, and so that song is made up of funny-sounding names of Mexican, Latin American, South American cities that we thought might entertain kids, and we just kept throwing in some Spanish and some English just to engage kids' minds and get them to dance to bilingual music.
Well, again, folks can go see and hear Ben Sidran at 2 o'clock on Sunday at White Theater at the Jewish Community Center out in Overland Park. For tickets, call 913-327-8054. And Ben, it's been such a pleasure. What an interesting life you've led, and I'm so glad you took a moment to share it with us here today.
Oh, thanks, Stephen. It's my pleasure, really, and I'm really looking forward to coming to Kansas City.
Sounds good. Again, that's Ben Sidran.